Starting? Okay. I'm going to do the introduction live tomorrow, so we'll just start today. Well, I know you've been on just about every talk show on television and radio, so I'm sure it's a real thrill for you to finally get the opportunity to be doing Fresh Air this afternoon.
Well, I love the title, Fresh Air, because guess what? That's what my name, Phyllis, means. It means a green bough, and you realize that chlorophyll causes fresh air.
Right, okay.
So it's just dear to my heart, this title, Fresh Air.
You didn't start comedy until you were 37. And what were some of the jobs you had before that? What were some of the things you were doing before you became a comedian?
Well, for 5 years, I was what you call a working housewife, which is the worst kind of redundancy in the world. And I had writing jobs. The first one was a newspaper, regular reporter and columnist, and then layout artist with copywriting for stores, and then advertising copy, and then continuity at a radio station, and then press relations at a radio station, and that was sort of it. Those were the jobs I had for 5 years.
Were you considered the funny woman on the block or the funny woman in the neighborhood?
Definitely, always.
What did you do to deserve that reputation?
Well, everything from childhood on that I dealt with in a humorous way. To me, life is funny. You see, to people who feel, life is sad, and to people who think, life is funny. You've heard that quote, I'm sure.
No, I haven't, actually.
So I wish I could remember who said it, because it's brilliant and it's true.
What led you into comedy?
My first husband.
And he suggested, I mean, why did he suggest that you do it? You hadn't had any professional training, you were already in your late 30s. It was not a clear-cut, obvious thing that you would be a great success.
No, it certainly wasn't. But you said, why did he do it? Milton Berle had just signed a $10 million contract with NBC, and we were gradually becoming impecunious. And he felt that I was terribly funny and maybe even funnier looking than Milt in drag. So he not only suggested that I do it, he insisted that I become a comic.
Did you need the money badly?
Well, we weren't making it. Let's face it. We were spending my inheritance and coming to the end of it, and that meant we weren't going to be in trouble one of these days.
So you were really concerned about finances at the time. You had five children?
Yes. I was very concerned, obviously. He was, too.
So, okay, so he decided you should become a comedian, make some money for the family. Well, then what?
What I said. How? Well, I was sitting at my desk one day at the radio station, and I thought, how do you do this? Because by then I had argued with him for 2 years. You know, I told him, you're out of your mind. And then finally, after 2 years of arguments, one day I said, okay, I'll do it. Then I thought, how? And I picked up the phone, and I called the Red Cross. And I said, I have a show. Where do you want it?
The Red Cross?
Yes.
Why'd you call them?
They put on shows.
Oh. So that was your first show?
That was it. It was at the Presidio. It's a naval hospital in San Francisco. And my first show was in a room with four beds. Four poor devils lying there, helpless, couldn't get away from me. They shoved in a piano on wheels, and I had my son with me, who played Dixieland banjo at that time, and my dearest friend, who was a news hand, announced our show to four beds. I have got three people. There were almost as many on stage as there were in the beds.
This is really a captive audience.
They're captive. None of them could move.
What kind of material did you perform for them?
I played the piano. I told jokes. My kid played the banjo. My friend announced me, and we talked a little, and it was nerve-wracking.
It's great because usually in hospitals, people who are recovering say, don't make me laugh. It hurts.
True. In fact, I shared a room one time in a hospital in Alameda, California, with a lady who had stitches. And do you know that she had herself taken home because I had her laughing so hard that she was afraid she'd blow her stitches, and she left early because she couldn't stand the laughter.
So was your response good enough in the hospital room that you figured you could take it to a club after that?
No. It was good enough to get me invited back, though. And the second time they invited me back to the Presidio, they put me in the psychiatric ward. And here are all these poor zombies shuffling around in their white jammies. Again, I had my banjo-playing kid. And this time, people at the radio station, who all wanted to be in showbiz, and they were from the television station, they all wanted... See, a lot of people who work around these places really want to be stars. So they found out that I was doing this, and they all got on the bandwagon, and we all went there But when they found that we were in the psychiatric ward, they lost their gut. They lost their courage. But I didn't, you see. You've heard the expression, no guts?
Mm-hmm.
One guy, we're playing his entrance music. We played it 3, 4, 5 times. He was out in the hall throwing up.
Gosh. So how did you go over in the psychiatric ward?
That's called fear.
Right.
I went over great.
So finally you made it into a club. You called
them
up.
Well, I had an audition. I had an audition at a Discovery Club in San Francisco, where out of which came the Kingston Trio, the Smothers Brothers, Jim Nabors, Rod McEwen, many, 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 many others.
This is the Purple Onion?
That's the Purple Onion, yes. So I got a job there. And from that time on, I have never been out of work.
What was your routine like?
It was very different because I had no idea what I was doing. Therefore, I was terribly different. There were no female comics around. I was it. I didn't know that. But I had no precedent. I had never seen anything excepting what I had seen on the early days of television in black and white, like Milton Berle, Maury Amsterdam, Art Carney, all men. And there they were. And so I was drawing on my background, my educational background. I did the spoof of a concert, a classical concert. I started with Handel, went through German Lieder, and I did the German, and then I did phony captions, you see. I did a parody of Amahl and the Night Visitors by Giancarlo Minotti, and in my version, her son had lost all his marbles. I did Ima Sumac. At that time, I had a very high voice. And my drum was an oatmeal box, and I had a band on my head with baby shoes and bottle caps. It was madness. I didn't have any idea. I made fun of current high fashion. And finally, little by little by little, I got material. Little by little. I used to read Dear Abby columns and change a few words to make them silly.
What got, once you started coming back, once you were a success there and they started booking you back again at the Purple Onion, because you had a pretty long run there, how did you change your routine? What did you decide to keep and what did you start throwing out?
Well, what I decided to keep was the talk and throw out the music, because I discovered very early in the game that I could get more laughs with words than with music. And sometimes with the music, I was so semi-good that they thought I was being serious. So one of my first rules was never have an audience be in doubt. They must know whether it's funny or serious. And I was borderline in the beginning, because I used to sing some songs straight. And you see, I didn't know what I was doing. I was looking. I was testing. I was trying. I was experimenting. So it came out talk and less music.
What did you do in those early days if you were bombing or if there were hecklers in the audience?
I acted like a pro. I never blamed the audience, never went after the audience. And after each show, I analyzed. If it was a failed show, I analyzed, why did I fail? Without ever blaming the audience.
Would you play off the hecklers?
Never, never, never. I don't recognize hecklers. Never have.
That's interesting. You went on the road with your husband for a few years.
Many years, yes.
Yeah, after the Purple Onion. Were your children grown up yet?
No, they were, when I first started, they were 6 to 16, and I had a year when I worked at home. But then the day came when I had to leave. And fortunately, it was not too far away. It was Hollywood from San Francisco, which meant I could get home every other weekend. But this was a great traumatic event for the family, because it left my husband, Sherwood Diller, there with the 5 children in our little split-level stucco, California style. And from then on, it just sort of evolved. We realized that we couldn't take the children with us because you can't move 9 rooms of furniture every 2 weeks. I had to find that out the hard way. So we gave all that away, sent the children to be with relatives. The 16-year-old son was old enough to take care of himself. He was a boy. So then was on the road again.
Did you have any second thoughts about leaving your children for a period so that you could get on the road and establish yourself?
I suffered terribly. No normal mother who is separated from her children is not going to suffer emotionally and spiritually. But we do what we have to do in this life, and what I did had to be done. I had to make the living. So in the long run, this would be the better living. And I made this clear to my children, even when they were very young. I said, we're making a trade deal here. See, I had been in advertising. I understood those things. I said, for what you're sacrificing, you will be well repaid.
So how did you repay them?
I promised them each a room of their own and a swimming pool. And they got it.
My guest is Phyllis Diller. How did you start telling stories about Fang, the husband that you use in your routines?
That was an ad lib. I remember in The Purple Onion when I was searching for material, trying out new things every night, and I had a bit about having had an accident in the car, his car, of course, and how I was calling home after the accident to tell old Fang Face. Because the minute you're in trouble, he's the heavy. And it was an ad lib. And then I shortened old Fang Face to Fang Face. And originally he was a guy with one tooth 2 inches long. Then I got rid of that, and he was just Fang. And that remained, and I worked on it and realized that I was on to something because this idiot that I portray on stage has to have a husband. And he's got to be even more idiotic than I.
How'd you come up with the name Fang? Did it just come to you?
Well, it was an ad lib, as I explained. Old Fang Face, shortened to Fang Face, and then Fang.
All the men comics of the period were telling wife jokes. Was this your answer to wife jokes, to do husband jokes about Fang?
Not consciously. It's just that you do on stage whatever is going to get laughs. I was just simply testing, trying everything out. I didn't do anything consciously. I just wanted laughs, that's all.
Did people assume that Fang really was your husband, that you had this, like, absolutely crazy husband?
Well, they still do. Every time I'm seen with a man, they say, are you Fang? Everybody wants to meet Fang. Everybody wants to see Fang. Everybody is interested in Fang. They love him. I've built a monster.
How did your husband feel knowing that people would assume that he was Fang?
My first husband adored the idea of being known as Fang. He loved it. He had stationery made up with nothing but Fang on it. And he liked it very, very much. I guess it gave him some sort of importance, which he enjoyed.
So Fang didn't have to do with your divorce then?
Nothing to do with the divorce.
Did you keep telling Fang jokes after your divorce? Because as a celebrity, your divorce would have been reported in all the papers, and people might have assumed, well, she divorced Fang, so now there has to be a new husband in her routines.
Well, let me tell you how serious that was. At that time, Red Skelton, who had become a mad fan of mine, as I was of him all my life, as a child even, he had contracted to do a Phyllis and Fang sitcom with me. And they gave me $30,000 of hold you money. In other words, everybody wanted me at this time. I was hot as a pistol. So they held me till they could get it all together. During that period, I divorced Sherwood Diller. And they said, keep the money and scrap the idea. That's how they felt. You see, everybody felt that if I divorced Fang, my career was over. Aren't people stupid?
So I guess people couldn't just accept it as part of the sketch that you did.
Well, they still don't. You see, you really have to hit people over the head with truth. They see it their way, but you see, I see it my way. And the thing is, Fang is just one of the many mythical characters that I've invented. It's like a comic strip. All of these are invented characters, just like Peanuts is the center.
Well, let's talk about the character you invented for yourself.
Oh, how about
her? On stage, yeah. Okay, describe the way you will typically come out for a performance.
Like a maniac, dressed silly, with silly hair, funny little boots, little gloves. All clowns wear gloves, even Mickey Mouse. And I wear gloves, the little teeny short gloves, and a little short dress, and that's it. It's a funny persona. And this woman is an idiot, you know. She's a harridan. She comes out. She's telling everybody what's wrong with everything, you know.
How did you develop her?
Little by little by little. It's called evolution. Started out like the woman next door. Brown hair, dress off the rack, please.
But slowly you started to come out more crazy, almost disheveled looking. I mean, your hair would just be this teased mop on top of your head, a wig, I assume.
No, that was my real hair.
Was it your real hair?
Oh, yes. Now, here's the way that happened. I had bleached it for so many years when I decided that I had to be theatrical. You're on stage. For goodness sakes, woman, don't look like the woman next door. Look theatrical. So the first thing I did was bleach my hair. And I did it myself for time reasons and money reasons. I just stripped it, okay? I ruined it. Now I decide I better save my hair. So I go to a famous scalp clinic in New York, and they gave me a curry comb, and I was supposed to brush it. And I have very short hair. Well, they said, now lean over and do this. Well, I leaned over and did it between interviews, and I'd be on television, my hair standing straight up. And you know what? People liked it. It caught on. That's how it was invented. You see, it was just an accident. I would never have thought of that.
So you designed your own image. You designed your own clothes, too? Did you decide what to wear on stage?
Well, you see, I used to dress pretty square, pretty straight. The first few years, I wore actual... One year, I wore Chanel suits. Another year, I wore a Balmain suit. And they were satin and shiny. And I realized I had to wear something shapeless or I couldn't make jokes about my body.
Because your body was too nice?
That's right. I hate to tell you that. So then I invented shapelessness. And to this day, I wear shapeless things so that I can tell them anything I want about my body.
What was your self-image like then? Because you'd get on stage and talk about how ugly you were and how, you know, your husband wouldn't come near you and all these jokes about that. And in fact, you probably had a terrific figure. You're probably, you know, a good-looking woman, but you'd made yourself into a crazy woman for the performance. So what was your self-image like deep down inside?
I was so busy carving out a career that I didn't have much of a problem with it. I mean, I wasn't a beauty. I was never a beauty. A beauty is sort of a way of life. A beauty is sort of the way you act. And I am not one of those people, a person who is concerned, so concerned with outer beauty that it would, you know, beauties are soft and they talk a certain way. Beauties don't talk like I talk. You know, I'm into the nitty-gritty. I'm into editing. See, my mother, when the phone rang, she picked it up and said, "State your business." So you see, I was not brought up to be a beauty.
One of the things you've always done is laugh at your own jokes.
True.
And it's an incredible laugh, especially on TV. Your mouth opens so wide when you're laughing. How did you develop that? Because it's unusual for a comedian to do that. It's the opposite of Jack Benny, for instance, who'd tell a joke and just turn his head a little bit and look away from the camera and raise his eyebrow.
Well, you see, at first it was nerves. I laughed because I was very nervous. And probably subconsciously I was showing the audience, here's where you're supposed to laugh. I don't laugh anymore at all in my act.
Oh.
None. Because to get 12 laughs a minute, as I do, there would be no time for a laugh. They're laughing. I'm waiting while they laugh to pick up that.
Is that why you dropped it, because it slowed it down?
No, I dropped it because I became secure and didn't have to laugh anymore. I became bought. I'm pre-advertised. They know who I am. See, when you're unknown, they don't know who you are, and they reject comedy. They reject female comedians worse than they do male comedians because they don't want women to be funny.
My guest is comedian Phyllis Diller. There were virtually no women headliners when you started performing.
There weren't any women, period.
In comedy.
Forget headliners. There weren't any.
Well, so what kind of reaction did you get when you were on tour and you're first getting started? This is before you were a known name. Were people reluctant to book a woman into their club?
No, they weren't. The bookers weren't reluctant to book. But I never worked in public as unknown, excepting when I was getting started, uh-huh. You know, that little club in San Francisco, because there would be no way to get a booking if you weren't known from television, because nobody would come to hear an unknown person. So I became known right away. It was very fast because, number one, it was the beginning days of television when there were only three networks. It's perforated now.
So people weren't reluctant to book you into clubs?
Oh, no, because they knew I was a winner. Operators did. Now you got to convince the public.
Was it hard to convince the public?
All you have to do to convince the public is to entertain them and make them laugh. That's up to you. You're either a success or you're a failure.
Was there a fraternity of comics that was hard to break into at the time? Who were the big comics at the time when you were breaking in?
Well, there were people like, of course, Jack Benny, Bob Hope, Sid Caesar. These were the biggies. These were the big George Burns. These were the names that had been around who are continuous. They're monumental. It was no problem at all. They loved me and accepted me immediately. It was amazing how they did that.
Was it kind of a novelty for people, too, to have a woman comedian?
Must have been.
There were some other women comics. I'm thinking of, like, Selma Diamond.
But wait.
Yeah.
She's not a stand-up comic.
She's done routines.
Wait.
Okay.
But wait. Let me explain. There are three categories.
Uh-huh.
Comedienne.
Mm-hmm.
Comic actress. Comic. Now, comic implies stand-up, responsible for your own material. You work in one, in front of a curtain, alone. No props, no music. Comedienne might use props, costume changes, dancing boys, dancing girls, and probably doesn't write all the material. Comic actress would be Lucy Ball, Carol Burnett. It's always written for them. It's a sketch, a movie, a play, and they work ensemble. See, this aloneness and just talking is what a comic is.
And there really were no others.
Diamond never worked a club or anything like that. If she did, it wasn't her major career. She's a character actress. You see, she's a comic actress.
It's important to you to write your own material. You've always written most of your own material, right? Had you ever thought about hiring writers, making your life easier? Had you tried that?
Well, I do. I always have. Once I could afford it, naturally, everyone would, does. Mm-hmm.
But so initially you wrote your own material?
All of it. Now I write 60%.
Is there any difference between what people write for you and what you write for yourself?
If there is, I don't buy it.
How do you go auditioning a good writer?
You don't audition. They send it to you in printed form.
Uh-huh. What do you look for?
Laughs. It must be hilarious, or I don't want to have anything to do with it.
Is there an example of something that really caught your eye immediately in a letter that you were sent with material on it, and you said, this person's good, I'll use them?
Well, when I find that, I do everything I can to nurture them and make it happen for them so they can become a professional writer and make their entire living from that. See, most of these people are doing it as a hopefully. And many, many of the comedy writers in Hollywood right now today, I was their first sale because I was an open market.
Like who?
Most people are so afraid to open the mail. They're so afraid that they'll be sued because if they read it, and they even come up with a joke that's like it, or maybe they already have a joke like it. They're so afraid. People live in fear, all kinds of fears. See, I have no fear. So I opened all the mail. So that way I'm responsible for a lot of writers that really made it.
Can you think of a line or anything that really caught you as soon as you opened up the mail and said, I've got to have that writer?
You don't say I got to have that writer, because the greatest line I ever bought was buried in 5 pages of single-spaced typewritten copy. And it was buried in a form that no one in their right mind could use because it wasn't even funny. The way the fellow sent it to me, he was obviously young. And remember, there was 5 pages of garbage. But I read all that. I found this line. This line was, but here's the way he had it couched. A guy was in a gutter bleeding after an accident and a cop kicks him. Isn't that awful?
Uh-huh.
But the line, get the line. He lost so much blood, his eyes cleared up. That's a funny line, providing it's set up properly.
So how'd you set it up?
In my act, Fang, who's a drunk, and shakes, cut himself shaving. Lost so much blood, his eyes cleared up.
That's good, right. Okay. So did you hire the writer?
Are you kidding? Are you kidding? That stupid kid. And then he did another stupid move. I was so enamored of that line that I used it on the Jack Parr Tonight Show before I had a chance to process this and get it back to him with the money. Now the kid writes me a letter accusing me of stealing the line. Now he gets a letter for me. I mean, if he could think this of me, he's a person I can't do business with at all. So I cut him off at the pass.
In your routines, you do pretty rapid fire.
Well, 12 laughs a minute is as fast as anyone can talk.
How do you build it up? Is there a model that you have about how jokes should build and when the capper should come on?
Oh, yes. The final word must be the joke word, must be the operative word. The final word should end in an explosive consonant, like pop or puck or kook. You understand? There are mellifluous words. Mellifluous is one of them. It flows. It's pretty. You know, it's one of those lovely words like lavender. You want something strong and pop at the end, like a shot. For years and years and years, people likened my delivery to machine gun fire.
Is there a rule of thumb you use about how many you can tell in a row like that before changing the subject?
Yes.
A sense of rhythm about that?
You find that out by doing them. You have a whole. You want to do as many as you can on one subject because you see it's economy. You have one setup, and then all the tag. You don't have to repeat the setup because every time you do a tag, it has to have a setup. But if you can have one setup and then as many as possible lines, but there is a limit to how many they will take on one character.
Can you give an example of the setup and a few tags?
Well, she's so fat that. That's your setup. And then you got all these tags, like sa-da-ba-da-dum, ba-da-da-doom, di-doom-doom-doom-doom. It's music.
You worked a lot with Bob Hope in several movies and TV shows. Do you feel like you learned anything from working with him?
Oh, boy, he's my guru.
Is he?
He taught me
yeah.
everything. He's taught me so much.
Can you explain any of the things he taught you?
He will often tell me how to deliver a line, and he will often... Well, actually, I don't know how to put it. I've copied him. I've used his timing. I've watched him work. I've watched how he handles everything. I've watched everything. He's a master of entrance and exit, and he's just the master.
You always strike me as being the forerunner of say Joan Rivers. You know that like one of Joan Rivers' models for a few reasons. First of all, because you're two of the few women who've made it to your stature in the world of comedy, but also because of your self-deprecating kind of humor, which she really has gotten into. Do you see any connection? Do you know her well?
Yes, she's my dear friend, and I don't know any other way for a female comic to get on. You have to beef about something because comedy is tragedy revisited. That's my definition of comedy. People say, what is comedy? Okay, if you come out and you're lovely and there's no comedy. So self-deprecation and denigration is par for the course. Works.
Do you think it's different for women than for men? Do you think that women more so have to have that kind of humor?
They need a little more help than men do because there's a double standard. Men can talk raunchy without being pilloried. Women are it's the Madonna complex, the Madonna syndrome. They're the mothers, the softies. And when a woman is going to be hard enough and aggressive enough to do comedy, she better have some saving graces. Like, look, I'm humble. I don't think I'm pretty.
Did you have to do that? I mean, do you feel like you had to do that to get in or something?
No. Uh-huh. Remember, I didn't know anything about what I was
right,
doing.
Right, okay.
Look, if I hear a laugh, it stays in. It's very simple.
Right.
Like if the bucket doesn't leak, don't repair it.
How did you react to the feminist movement?
Well, you see, I did what I did without a movement.
Right.
I became a single working woman supporting a family on my own. I'm not a flag waver or a banner carrier. I'm a worker. I believe in the work ethic. I think it's healthy. And I have goals, and I like to attain goals. And I'm willing to work extremely hard to get to a final destination.
Well, did you feel that this was a sympathetic movement, that here was a whole movement that was kind of based around what you had, the kind of life you had led?
Well, the life I led is so singular. The movement is a wonderful thing, and it's definitely needed because, obviously, again, we have a double standard. A woman doing the same job is paid less. Now, we know this is true. And the old reason was the woman is working for fun and the guy is the breadwinner. Now, that's no longer true. Most of the women who are out there working need the money. And most of them are the head of a family and the sole breadwinner. This should be taken into account. In fact, it shouldn't ever have had anything to do with it. Like one job I left in a radio station, I was replaced by three men. Another job that I took when I left that one, I was replacing two men. Now, this is how women work. They're worthy workers. They seem to get a lot more done sometimes than men do because they're so accustomed to handling so many various jobs as a woman.
Once the women's movement got rolling, did women's reaction to your material change at all?
Now and then a very young girl would try to get at me how wrong I was to say what I did about myself and the self-denigration jokes. However, I have to convince them that I do what I do because it gets laughs. Look, I'm not touting a movement. I'm not against it. I'm for it, naturally. I want women to be recognized as good workers and paid accordingly. I mean, that's common sense.
My guest is comedian Phyllis Diller. You were telling me before that I was telling you that I'd seen you a lot on TV, but that I hadn't seen you in a club, and you were saying it's very different. What are some of the differences between Phyllis Diller on TV and Phyllis Diller in a club?
It's a difference between 7 minutes and an hour. It's a difference between you getting a couple of laughs, a few laughs on television, very widely separated from the real person, and sitting in an audience with other people laughing to the point of where their cheeks hurt and their ribs hurt and they've slapped their knees till they're black and blue.
Is the content different?
Same content. It's the difference between the real thing and artificial insemination.
What's your career like now? What kind of material are you doing now? Has it changed?
Of course it changes. I stay up to date. Mm-hmm. I don't talk about Liz and Dick because that's over. I don't talk about Jackie and Ari because that's gone. I don't talk about astronauts because we just had a terrible basic tragedy. I took all my gay jokes out. They were marvelous jokes. They were wonderful jokes. But the moment that Rock Hudson died and went public, that all came out. In other words, I work on my material constantly and keep it fresh, like your show, Fresh Air.
You recently had plastic surgery, well, several times.
All the time.
All the time? What have you had?
Oh, have you got an hour? I've had everything. I've had 3 facelifts. The latest thing, I had that eyeliner put on, permanent tattoo. I had a chemical peel. I had a breast reduction. I had a tummy tuck. There's only one procedure I haven't had, and that's liposuction surgery or lipectomy, where they use a vacuum thing that was invented in Paris to suck out unwanted fat from places on your body where exercise doesn't affect.
You actually got an award from a plastic surgeon's group.
Yeah, the American Academy of Cosmetic Surgeons.
Yeah, and they kind of thanked you for going public.
Yes, they did.
And giving the business a good name so that people wouldn't be undercover about their own cosmetic surgery. What made you decide to go public with it? I guess maybe you had to once you were doing it because people know your face so well.
I don't think anyone would have noticed at all. I don't think they would have noticed at all. I did it because I'm just honest, and it would never occur to me. I don't think it's something to be covered. You see, if someone says, "What are you doing Thursday?" I say, "Well, I'm going fishing." Or like if they say, "What are you doing Friday?" I'm going to have my facelift. You see, it just came out. I didn't do that on purpose.
Why did you have all the plastic surgery?
I was ugly and beginning to look old.
Mm-hmm. Well,
old and wrinkled and hangy.
Uh-huh.
We're talking droop. Droop city.
You never seemed ugly to me. I mean, you seemed
good,
like,
good. Well, I was pleasant and I smiled and laughed.
And it's because you had character. And, I mean, there's a difference between, like, the perfect nose, which, you know, it's nice, it's the perfect nose, and somebody who obviously has character. And what you had was character, and whether you had the perfect nose or not wasn't really important.
Number one, I couldn't breathe through that nose. One side was open because of an accident I'd had. But I went because of my chin. I saw myself on television and something was, I think it's called wattle. My chin was coming down. I didn't like it at all. And my eyes had circles, not circles, puffs. Found out later that wasn't debauchery. It was fatty tissue. They plucked that out.
It's interesting because you'd made your career on being crazy looking, on putting yourself down, on being the frumpy housewife.
True.
So now, I mean, you look rather glamorous.
I hope so. But you see, I'm a single woman and I have a private life. My private life is very important to me. Very important. That's my real life. My life on stage is not real. I am a person. I am real. And I want to look good.
So can you go on stage now and do the frumpy bit?
I'm doing it.
Does it work with...
It works. I'm employed.
Um, Did the surgeons who performed the plastic surgery know who you were, and were they just a little intimidated or uncomfortable about changing a face that had already become so famous and well-documented on TV and in newspapers?
No, they were thrilled. They were thrilled to get their scalpel on me.
Did you feel when you started to see your face sagging and getting more wrinkles and everything that it somehow wouldn't be as funny to people to make jokes about your own looks as you were aging?
Never occurred to me. I live without fear. That would be a fear thought. I don't have fear and doubt thoughts because they're very debilitating.
So that didn't enter
into
it?
No. I just looked at myself and thought, forget it. People are eating.
If you had the perfect nose and lips and breasts and everything when you were getting started, do you think you would have gone into comedy?
Well, I did have the perfect breasts, the perfect figure, and my nose was crooked. Let me think. My teeth were crooked. Well, comedy is within. It has nothing to do with your appearance. My appearance helped because it was dysplastic. It helped. And then I made it help more by getting crazier and learning to be theatrical and things like that.
I know you're a real admirer of George Burns and of his staying power.
All those guys.
Performer.
I love him. You know, when Jack Benny died, he was booked way into the future.
But I'm thinking that someone like George Burns probably
90 years old.
Yeah, and he wouldn't be expected to have plastic surgery.
But he has.
He has, uh-huh.
But that would be my guess because I know a lot about it. And I've seen him recently and danced with him recently. And he's a marvelous man. These people care about their appearance just as much as anyone.
So you don't see this as something that women performers are more obliged to do than male performers?
My dear, men have it done. John Wayne had it done many times by my doctor.
Really?
Of course. You think of him as this big, old, western, true grit thing on that big leather saddle on the big old horse out into the wide open spaces. But when it comes to the big screen, think about it. What you want to see your face 7 feet tall with, you know, you want a certain look about you. Men want to stay young-looking just as much as women do.
So you have two personas, as you always did, one offstage and one onstage. And how are you dressing onstage now?
Crazy. But chic. I mean, it's satire of what is chic right now. That's the way I dress.
Such as?
Well, it has got very broad shoulders, you know. That's the look right now. And as ugly as it is, that's what they're wearing. So on stage, that is what I'm satirizing right now, costume-wise.
Are you still talking about Fang?
Oh, honey, he's so big in my act. He's one of my big numbers.
Is Fang aging?
Well, Fang is just Fang. The Fang things are, he's stupid, he's drunk, he's dumb, he's an idiot, he's lazy. He never moves. These are the Fang things.
Did you like wife jokes when how do you feel about them now?
I think they're wonderful. I love jokes. I love comedy. I worked with male comics who said, you've heard this is a classic because more than one comic I've heard say it, is where he's married to the woman who's so neat, you know, so neat. She's always, everything has to be perfect. And, you know, men don't like that. The joke that I loved, when he got up to go to the toilet one night, came back, the bed was made. Have you heard that joke?
No.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Can't you see this compulsive woman?
Yeah,
making this man's life miserable.
The problem I've always had with wife jokes is that they always seem to be about the whole genre of women. It's because they were never spouse jokes, because until you came along, there were no women telling jokes. So the joke was always on the woman and never on the man. So instead of being jokes about married life or having this lifelong companion, it was always jokes about women, jokes about dames. And in that sense, it seemed to put down the whole gender instead of... You know, talking about the tribulations of a long-lasting relationship that men or women would have. Do you know
True.
What I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. But I did some good work, didn't I?
Yes.
I almost have a cause.
You know, I'm looking at you now, and you're about 67 or something?
I will. In 18 months, I'll be 70.
Really?
Isn't that a miracle?
Yeah, well, you look in your late 50s, maybe.
Isn't that lovely?
Yeah, but I'm thinking, like, God, the expectations people must have of you that you have to fulfill, and you seem to be fulfilling them fine. I mean, you have a lot of energy. Your voice is in terrific shape. But, like, with your new face and everything, I was wondering if you maybe look a lot younger than you feel.
No, no, I feel younger than I look.
Really?
Yes, I feel wonderful. I feel good. You know why I'm happy? Happiness is the great, great healer.
Do you have any interest in retiring or anything? You want to keep
performing? None, whatever. I don't know of a comic who has ever retired. Name one.
Well, I assume a lot of... Well, some of them seem to go into forced retirement.
There, well, that's not retirement.
And others end up having kind of problems that keep them out of the running for a good deal of time. And then
well,
they make
but that's not really
combat.
Retiring,
No,
see.
It's not.
Comics have so much fun. They want to keep working. They love their work.
You have... you've been on TV for so many years. What are some of the ways you think TV has changed? Because you've done like all the shows plus a few series of your own.
Well, number one, the main thing is it's much looser. Our changing mores where people don't really have to get married to have children and they live together without being married. I mean, we've changed a lot, our society. And therefore, and language has changed. The words are allowed on television and almost semi-nudity is allowed on television, even on network TV. So these things have affected comedy. The doors are open. The floodgates are open.
Who are some of the newer comics that you like now?
I'm crazy about Steve Wright. And I saw, he looks like he just had an afternoon away from the home. I mean, he has a wonderful attitude. He's invented this fabulous persona. And let's see, there's a girl I just found recently, Rosanna Barr. She's kind of a fat lady comic. She was wonderful. She talks about the same things I do, the husband and the kids and stuff like that. What would a woman talk about? Wouldn't it be funny if somebody was like a... women's lib type female executive of like a big General Motors, and then she would talk about her problems. But you see, how funny would that be?
Well, as funny as a man doing it. I mean, if it's funny, I think it would probably be funny for either.
I wonder. That would be a whole different thing than most of us women do. We talk about our husband, our kids, and things like that. The usual women roles.
What do you do when you meet people, let's say... a function where you're invited to be the guest comedian or whatever, and they expect you off stage to be your character?
No, well, there are people, I'm sure, who expect me to get on an airplane as my character. And there are people who wouldn't even notice me in public because they would expect me to be that person. But mostly, if I'm in a social situation, people know better.
So you never have to set them straight?
No.
Okay.
Well, they take one look, they know.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been such fun, Terry. I really love your show.
Thanks for being here.